Thank you. So I think the mic is working. Is that good? Okay. So my co-authors are from USGS, Kristen Bird and Jason Kreitler, and from Oregon State University, John Bolte. So I'm going to talk about, give you some background on the EPM and talk about some of the context about its potential uses. And I'm going to, you're going to see that this is about evaluating future development scenarios for Puget Sound. And by development, I mean human beings converting land use to different stages of their own use. And the point here is that I want to characterize these scenarios in terms of endpoints that are of interest to decision makers and stakeholders. And I'm going to describe these scenarios a bit. Then I'm going to talk about the criteria and models that we use to evaluate the scenarios. And collectively, those models I refer to as the ecosystem portfolio model. And then as I talk about the models and present them, I'm going to talk about some preliminary results and discuss some next steps. This is very much a work in progress and hopefully will be ongoing who knows how long. Okay, so what is the Puget Sound Ecosystem Portfolio Model? It's a regional tool for supporting ecological restoration planning, and it's again a land use nearshore scenario evaluation. Here, land use conversion at a landscape scale, nearshore modifications in terms of things that human beings do to the nearshore, so things like putting in armoring and docks, marinas, that sort of thing. And the EPM is comprised of a GIS implemented spatially explicit models. That are based on metrics that relate these land use and nearshore changes to ultimately changes in human well-being. That's a very tall order that requires a modeling a chain of influence as you go from drivers to impact. So again, we're in the middle of this. So in many cases, we're not all the way at human well-being quite yet. We're somewhere in the middle. And the purpose of this ultimately is to be used by the Puget Sound Nearshore Ecosystem Restoration Project. I'll talk a little bit about what that is in a second. Suffice it to say, it's mostly about the Army Corps of Engineers getting money from Congress to do some restoration projects. And they have a suite of analyses, which I'll discuss very briefly. But this is about its general investigation, which is the big body of analysis that they present to Congress when they ask for a big check to do restoration. And there are some other users and uses that I will mention briefly. So what is PISNERP? Its mission is to restore nearshore habitat of Puget Sound for the benefit of bioresources, integrity of the ecosystem. And they very much take a restore the processes point of view rather than restore structures. You may have heard something of that in this seminar before. But again, restoring processes, not structures, so that the processes maintain the structures in the future. And that ultimately ends up in doing things like restoring habitat and restoring ecosystem function. At least that's the idea. So, what is the nearshore? And I'm going to look at my notes here because this is their very compact definition. And again, it is their definition. It's not necessarily the one you find in an oceanography textbook, but they describe it as the estuarine delta marine shoreline. In areas of shallow water from the top of coastal banks and bluffs down to a depth of about 10 meters relative to mean low water. That, of course, is a very technical definition, but if you look at the picture, you get kind of an idea. Tops of banks and bluffs down to basically the bottom of the photic zone is the idea. So, the project phases for their request for information, I'm sorry, for their provision of information to Congress. They have these stages. The one that we are interested in is the, sorry, let me get the pointer, is the general investigation, which is a kind of feasibility report to Congress. So, how feasible is the restoration plan they're providing is the idea. And so, as part of that feasibility study, PISNERP is doing several related analyses. One is referred to as the change analysis, which is about, it's basically about what has happened to the landscape and nearshore between 1850 and current. And I'll talk about that very briefly in a second. And then they want to think about, well, what might happen in the future. So, a GIS-based analysis of the past, and then a projection of how land use and nearshore might change into the future. And then the EPM answers the question, what do these changes mean for these scenarios? So they're change analysis. For the intents of my project, this is really about the geodatabase that they've created to do their change analysis. Again, for comparing reconstructed maps and layers from the 1850s to current land use and nearshore condition, defined here as the year 2000. The major data that they've used are shore forms information based on the shore zone database. That's a very big database. The point here is that the scale is not the scale that's ideal for doing a lot of the modeling that we want to do, but we're very constrained by the fact that that's the information that's available. When you do this kind of work, often you're very limited by the data that you have available to you to do the analysis. So it really kind of ties your wrists, but you have to move forward and be brave. So nearshore modifications and buffer zones, there are many data sources and lots of data cleanup involved here. A lot of the work that they did in the change analysis was about cleaning up this data and collecting it. Land cover data ultimately based on Landsat information using NOAA's CCAP and the PRISM, which is UW classification system. So this is about taking this raw remote sensing information, classifying it based on a classification system that's used to you. So you put it in terms of a characterization of the world that's useful from a modeling perspective. Elevation and bathymetry data, most or all of it ties back to Finlayson in his work here at UW, again through PRISM. So changing gears and thinking about moving from the past to the present on into the future. So part of this project is the scenario development aspect of this. And this work was done by Oregon State University, and they, through working with Pisner, came up with three land use and nearshore modification scenarios up to 2060. And the three scenarios are status quo plan trend, where they assume that the Puget Sound Action Agenda has been implemented. Does Puget Sound Action Agenda mean anything to you guys? I hope it does. That's more or less the roadmap that the Puget Sound Partnership is going to use as they try to restore Puget Sound by 2020, which is a tall order if I've ever heard one. And it also assumes that current trends and existing growth plans are going to be implemented, and that there is something of a restoration conservation emphasis. Now, I'll tell you in a second how these scenarios are done so you'll understand what these assumptions mean in terms of the scenario generation. The second scenario is managed growth, where it assumes a compact growth, or it enforces a compact growth pattern where the impact of nearshore modifications are more limited, fewer go in, and it assumes aggressive restoration and conservation policies. And then the unconstrained growth scenario, where the less restrictive development pattern, less restrictive policies, it's less of a conservation orientation. Now, in one of the main things that this is about is in unconstrained growth, a lot of the assumed development occurs outside of the urban growth areas. So, you know, the urban growth areas, I think since this is a forestry department, you probably are pretty well aware of those. So this is a lot of this is about where the growth occurs with respect to the urban growth areas. So a little bit about scenarios versus predictions. Scenarios are not predictions. This is about coming up with plausible maps that are divergent and that are useful and meaningful. So we don't know what's going to happen between now and 2060. That's, you know, it's kind of a pipe dream to think that you could come up with a prediction of what Puget Sound will look like in 2060. So what you want to do is come up with a series of scenarios that kind of span that huge misty space so that you can think kind of realistically. It probably will be somewhere in the middle of these scenarios. So if you evaluate the scenarios, you've kind of spanned this huge uncertain space. And in these scenarios, the major driver is development. So environmental development, environmental protection policies and development rules are the major drivers of interest in these scenarios. one of the major limitations of this work right now is that climate change impacts and sea level rise are ignored. That's because of resource restrictions, including time. This, of course, is obviously a very important thing, and in future work, we certainly hope to incorporate this into scenarios. But in the if you have seen the deadlines that the Army Corps of Engineers is up against, you'll understand why you have to do things like make assumptions like this. You have to you're given a deadline. Imagine it it's kind of like homework. You have to turn it in Monday morning, so you have to do the best that you can do. But the good news is with the government is that you get to take another pass on it into the future. So this is kind of a living set of scenarios and evaluations that will improve as time goes on. One of the big changes will be incorporating climate change and sea level rise impacts. So how do we generate these scenarios? This is John Bolte from Oregon State University, his Envision suite. So here the scenario definition comes from defining agents on the landscape. The agents here are defined as the actual parcels. So this is agent-based modeling. So you imagine a parcel asking the question, will I develop or not? And if I do change, what will I change to? That's the definition of the actor. What they're constrained by are the policies that you give to these agents. So you tell them a set of rules that they tend to follow. You give them information on what the world looks like. And they say, how do I behave given these policies? So you give them different sets of policies, and that's what defines a scenario. So before, where I was talking about restrictive environmental protection and development rules that tend to promote compact growth, that's what I mean, is that these policy sets promote those kinds of activities. You give them three different policy sets, you end up with three different landscapes. So what the EPM does is it takes the landscape generated by Envision, and it runs a set of evaluation models against them. And when the loop is closed, you can actually have these agents look at these evaluation models and take them into consideration. Right now, this loop is not closed. Again, that's future work. The autonomous change process is part here. That's how the landscape changes independent of the actors. So something like climate change, sea level rise impacts, you can impose on the landscape. The agents see those changes, and so you have this kind of little model of the way the world really works, very simplified, of course, but with feedbacks and things happening you have no control over and things happening that you have some control over. So agent-based modeling is very intriguing. If you've never heard of it, I would certainly suggest that you look at it, because I think it's going to have a lot to do with the way future work is done in this kind of scenario generation work. So the scale at which the simulations are done, they're done at the basin unit. So if you imagine that these little parcels are each individual agents, when you get to large scales, you can literally have hundreds of thousands of agents all interacting in this model. Right now, from a computational point of view, you can't run it at the scale of Puget Sound, so instead you run it at the basin scale. So the fundamental problem here is you're given a population increase. So you hand this system, say, put some people on the landscape at the basin scale. It looks at the rules. It looks at where there is capacity to put people, and it comes up with a solution for that problem given its constraints. So that's how these land use and nearshore changes are simulated. So here's an example of a set of scenarios. This is the 2000 baseline. The redder colors here are essentially land use development occurring. So baseline here, when you get to the unconstrained growth, you see a lot more red. That's a lot more development occurring. Here, the status quo, less red, more highly constrained. In the managed growth scenario, less red yet. And again, it tends to cluster. So another way of looking at this is the proportion of the growth that occurs within the urban growth area. For unconstrained growth, you're getting more and more growth outside of the urban growth area. This is roughly 2020. This is 2060. For status quo, you get a little bit of increase outside the urban growth area. For managed growth, you actually have more of the growth occurring inside the urban growth area. So now moving on from the scenarios to the evaluation metrics and models. So John's scenarios are my inputs. So here you have a kind of a cartoon of a collection of scenarios that have land use change and nearshore change represented within the model. And then we run these scenarios against multiple metrics. So examples are nearshore condition metrics, like things like water quality, coastal erosion potential, things that are of interest in the nearshore, of interest to decision makers and stakeholders. Valued ecosystem components, which are essentially species and habitats that people tend to like for various reasons. It can be reasons as selfish as I like to eat fish to, you know, I like to observe nature. So there are lots of reasons why people put value on ecosystem components, but that's the focus there. Recreation metrics are another big cluster. So state park visitations, shoreline accessibility and condition, and so on. And you can take this pretty far. As you'll see, we have to, given our constraints, we can't get that far. But you can take this all the way to modeling regionally water availability and use, water quality, and so on. You can model the economy. So what implications do these scenarios have for the regional economy? You can take this really far. You can make, again, like I said, a little model of the world. But I want to kind of keep that out there as a goal that we are trying to get towards, along with a lot of other people. But so when I show you what we're actually doing, you can see the context that we're aiming towards. Otherwise, it doesn't look quite as impressive. So keep what we're aiming towards in mind. This is another view of what we're trying to do. This is a DPSR model. I think you guys have heard that before. Basically, driver, pressure, state, impact, response. So here, you have human activities and drivers, like changing land use, changing nearshore condition. It has intended as well as unintended consequences that affect the landscape and the nearshore state. That has unintended consequences on other human activities, things that people value. So the activities that they're doing in the first place that have the impacts, as well as the activities that are impacted, both have competing effects on human well-being. So you can imagine this is a little scale wobbling back and forth as people do things and have their other activities hampered. Societal response, you can try to change these activities so that you affect this human well-being teeter-totter. So this is kind of another view of what the model that we're trying to create. Again, we're trying to think about how activities ultimately affect the world, and the world affects our activities, and how that affects human well-being. And if you're not familiar with it, the Millennium Ecosystem Assessment uses human well-being as a way of thinking about the effect that ecosystem change has as well. So it's kind of a all of these things can be kind of superimposed on each other. The Millennium Ecosystem Assessment view of the world, the DPSR view of the world, and the scenario development. They're all kind of all different versions of models of complex systems. So how do we choose our metrics? Well, the Puget Sound Partnership right now has a lot of parallel things going on where they're coming up with lists of indicators. And those indicators have everything are related to things like ecosystem state as well as to human well-being. They are trying to track this from the question of whether or not the action agenda is working, so kind of a post-action monitoring plan. They're trying to come up with their own little model of what Puget Sound is and how it changes. So this activity is going on in parallel. Their purposes are a little bit different than ours, and their timescales are different than ours, but this is still useful information to our list of metrics. The Puget Sound Georgia Basin Human Dimensions Forum is also occurring in parallel, and they're trying to come up with ways of thinking about human well-being in Puget Sound as well. And we held a workshop here at the University of Washington last April, where the participants included PISNRP, the Puget Sound Partnership, the Nearshore Science Team, which is an arm of PISNRP, consultants, academics, and so on. And the question is, whose values do these metrics represent? Well, we don't have the resources and time to do original work in that, so we have to rely on the stakeholder process that PISNRP is doing and that Puget Sound Partnership is doing, and they tell us whose values to represent, and we use the literature and things like that. That kind of work is very time-consuming and expensive and very valuable as well. We had some metric modeling workshops and meetings in parallel to this, and I'll talk a little bit about those. And the take-home point is very ambitious project goals, limited resources, and what I'm going to show you is the best that we can do this year. We'd like to include additional criteria in the future and to improve the criteria that we're using right now. So this is the phase one list. So the criteria are eelgrass habitat suitability, forage fish spawning potential, fecal pathogen index, shellfish growing area closures, this is a related bundle, beach erosion index, nearshore recreational visits, and nutrient loadings to the nearshore. Now, when you first read this list, you might say that doesn't really sound like it's related to human well-being so obviously. But what I would say is that some of them are more obvious, like beach erosion index and nearshore recreational visits, but something like eelgrass habitat suitability is relevant to questions of biodiversity, habitat, provisioning of food, and so on. So we want to ultimately take this further so you can get to something like effects on fish harvests and so on. But again, we're sort of at the beginning of this, but we want our metrics to kind of scatter as you go from drivers to activities that are impacted. So it's kind of a complicated, big system of effects, and you want your metrics to span that system. So here's an example. The land, water, human connection, using bluff-backed beaches as an example. So we start with a scenario of shoreline modifications and land use change that affect bluff-backed beaches, so something like putting armoring on. And that has a couple of different classes of effects as well as others. Beach geomorphology changes, changes in erosion potential, beach water quality changes, increased pathogen concentrations related to land use. And then these two classes of changes are related to endpoints of interest like recreational beach use, forage fish habitat, shoreline stability and landside risk, and on the water quality side, recreational beach use and shellfish harvests. So here we're tracing all the way from the scenarios to these endpoints of interest. So we want to pick metrics that capture the change as well as the endpoints of interest. And I'm going to show some examples of that. So nearshore recreational visits, again, one of the criteria. So this is a model where we're trying to model the change in recreational visitation as development occurs. As you put people on the landscape, how do you predict changes in park visitation rates? So what direction will they change in? Will you get increases or decreases? And where will they change? Which parks will change? How important is the future land use pattern to these predictions of change? And we wanted to do this, we want to determine the factors responsible for the patterns of recreational use, and we want to forecast how changes in population and land use may affect these visitation rates. So visitations to Puget Sound, state parks around Puget Sound, they vary considerably in the numbers of visitations. You have parks that have as few as 500 or so visitations per year, all the way to 1.5 million visitations per year. So you have a very wide variety of parks. And at Puget Sound wide, in 2008, there were roughly 12 million visits, or around 3 per capita. So regionally, this is a very important endpoint of interest to the people that live here. So our model, we model visitation rate as being a function of the shoreline condition and nearshore condition, demand for use of the parks, and access to the parks. So condition is roughly described in terms of environmental quality, park characteristics and amenities, demand as a function of the number of people nearby, and access as a function of a travel cost model and legal access. Other variables we've looked at and we're continuing to look at are things like shellfishing effort, water quality related ones, ferry access, and so on. So this is an example of the managed growth scenario, how it changes between now and 2060. So this is new visits. The larger the bubble, the more additional visits that are occurring to that park per year. And this is the relative increase. So you can see a general pattern is that at the smaller parks in Island County, you get a much larger relative increase than something like, say, Deception Pass, where the relative increase is kind of small, but the absolute number of visits is pretty big. So the take-home point here is that we can use this model to evaluate the different scenarios and compare them to one another, so you can comment on what these land use patterns might mean in terms of park visitation. Now, you can take this further, of course, and put a dollar value that people place on park visitations and look at regional changes in state park recreational value and things like that. So the next steps for this, we want to think about the question of substitutes. So parks compete with one another for visitors. So as you put people in different places, the ability for these guys to compete with one another changes. We want to consider that. Right now, populations are considered in terms of a threshold. So if you're a certain distance away, the model sees that. What we want to look at is representing population in a little bit more detailed way. We want to look more at detailed park characteristics and amenities and their effects on visitation. And in terms of environmental variables, we want to find a good signal that varies through these scenarios that allow us to think about this. When you look at visitation data, environmental quality isn't a very strong signal. Most of this signal has to do with distance right now. So we're not the only group in the world dealing with this problem when you want to start thinking about how environmental quality changes and how it affects something like recreation. Unfortunately, that is not the strongest signal in the world. But in theory, there's at least a threshold where a big effect would occur, but that's pretty hard to find. So moving on to the pathogen index shellfish growing area closures. This data comes from the Washington Department of Health and Department of Ecology. So here, these little circles represent different classifications that the Department of Ecology provides. So reds mean fair to poor, so basically a shellfish closure, and the yellows are operational. So you want to think about how changing land use patterns and near shore changes would affect this growing area, open growing areas versus closed growing areas, and how that would affect that. So this is a very useful indicator because shellfish is obviously a very important activity in Puget Sound. We want to take this a little bit further, all the way to thinking about flushing times, again, in a fairly simple way, because we're looking at long time periods. But the Department of Ecology right now is developing this simple flushing time model. We want to think about this in terms of seasons. And ultimately, we want to ask fairly sophisticated questions like, what is the potential exposure of these pathogens to consumers? And on monthly timescales, does the increased pathogen risk coincide with higher consumption periods? So exposure is a pretty complicated question. It's not just are pathogens making it into the growing areas, it's are they making it into growing areas at times when people are eating and collecting the shellfish for eating. So again, this is fairly complicated stuff on any one model. Going through several of these at once in a very limited way, and then I'm going to focus on one in the time I have remaining. So the forage fish spawning potential metric, right now we don't have a very good model for this. We're basically using the Department of Fish and Wildlife SalmonScape data, which is a statewide database where they've collected over decades data on where forage fish spawning is occurring. So we're just really looking at, if I'm going to change the near shore, is this a spawning? Does this coincide with the spawning area? That's the best we can do right now. But we're working with them to develop a model where we can estimate does it have good spawning potential or not based on conditions. So developing an actual model for that is a goal. Nutrient loading to the near shore, we're using the USGS Sparrow model. which is a statistical model that relates land use and other nutrient sources and sinks to nutrient concentrations and loadings within a stream network. And this model will route these concentrations and loads to the nearshore, so we can change land use patterns and estimate how those nutrient loadings are going to change in the nearshore. The question then, of course, becomes what happens to those nutrient loadings and how does it affect things like nearshore condition, algal blooms, and things of that nature. That is somewhere where we ultimately want to go. Again, in a simple way, complicated stuff thought about in a simple way. Eelgrass habitat suitability, we're using the controlling factors model, which was developed by the Pacific Northwest Lab, Ron Tom, and others. And this relates local conditions to a scored model of eelgrass habitat suitability. And if I'm imagining this means something to all of you here, but eelgrass habitat, of course, is an extremely important environment in Puget Sound. It's important for a wide variety of reasons. And ultimately, again, we want to tie this eelgrass habitat to these endpoints of interest to people. So I'm going to talk a little bit more detail about the beach erosion index. This focuses on bluff-backed beaches. Why? Because these are the big sediment sources that build and maintain beaches in Puget Sound. At least that's the theory. Really, the state of the art here is pretty primitive. And this looks at the relative potential of a beach to erode due to the loss of that sediment supply from nearshore armoring. So a bluff-backed beach is a sediment source. You put up a seawall that prevents that from providing sediment, you get erosion downstream is the cause and effect. The data sources we have available from the PISNR Change Analysis Geodatabase, drift cells, armoring, and shore forms. Again, the scales are not ideal, and the quality of the data is not ideal for thinking about this, but it's the best that we have. So the general concept is, how will armoring affect beaches at the armoring site as well as downdrift of the armoring location? And we're modeling this as a factor of fetch distance. Fetch is simply the amount of distance that wind has to act on water to build up wave energy, which affects beach erosion and as well as sediment delivery. The armoring length locally, and the armoring length on sediment sources, so bluff-backed beaches within the beach's divergent zone. So armoring at sources, local armoring, and wave energy. So here the beach index is applied to south-central Puget Sound. 0 to 1 is essentially, the blue is essentially low erosion potential, the red is high erosion potential. So along red segments, you would anticipate that you're going to have erosion over time. Now, we want to get more quantitative and get to the point where this index tells you something about the amount of sediment you can expect to be losing, and maybe taking it to something like you can expect to see a big change in beach width, you know, observations like that, but right now we're not quite there. And here we're comparing two scenarios for Bainbridge Island, the managed growth scenario and the unconstrained growth scenario. So here you have some beaches going from low erosion potential to high erosion potential, and from medium to low. So you have changes in both directions. Now, one of the potential problems with the scenarios right now that we've observed using this index, this is one good reason for using these indices, is it can tell you something. If you start seeing things you didn't expect to see, you can question whether your scenario is good or not. Right now, the amount of new armoring goes in, it appears to be too small. So that's one of the things we want to revisit. Now, you can do things like overlaying this beach erosion index with park visitation projections and forage fish spawning locations. So the purple here are park visitation numbers. So if you start predicting that you're going to have beach erosion in a state park, that's of great interest, especially one that will become more important in the future. And if you have beach erosion in forage fish spawning areas, that's also of great interest because you can lose the habitats that result in the fish spawning. You start affecting fish spawning, you start having effects up the food chain. So here, these are relatively simple overlays, but we would like to get to the point where we can say how beach erosion might affect park visitation numbers and how beach erosion might affect forage fish spawning numbers and so on. But again, that's, you know, that's way down. That's very complicated stuff to do, but we're trying to think about how to do it simply. So we want to take this a little bit further and start building, do a network analysis to get at the quantity of loss of sediment supply to public beaches. Hopefully this isn't too complicated for the venue, but essentially the green circles are sediment sources, the red circles are sediment sinks, the yellow arrows are net flow directions, and so we plop down a start of a network trace, like here, for example, and then we follow where sediment is moving around within drift cells, and we hopefully will get to the point where we can say something a little bit more quantitative about how much sediment you're expecting to lose and how that might affect beach width. But again, this is almost like thinking out loud because we're not there yet. And again, the underlying data representation is not ideal, so one of the things we're working on is coming up with much better maps of geomorphology and sediment sources. We're working with Jim Johansson from he's a consultant, and he has some good maps on about 30% to 40% of Puget Sound right now, and he would very much like to do the rest of Puget Sound. And when that data is done, we'll be able to do this kind of modeling a lot better. There's a little plug for Jim. So again, back to the context. The EPM, again, is a suite of evaluation models. So we're building the scenarios, we're evaluating them, and we want to ultimately be able to put them in this larger system where you have a little model of the world, where the landscape is changing both from the way people are acting as well as from things happening outside of our more direct control. We have an indication of how the landscape is changing, feed it back to the actors, and so on. This should ultimately lead to the ability to develop these scenarios in a much more sophisticated and meaningful way. I'm not trying to claim we're anywhere close to that right now. This is pretty simple stuff at this point, but that is the vision. So where would we like to go in the next 2 years or so? We want to improve the scenarios. We would like to include sea level rise and impact scenarios. One big thing that might occur are climate refugee scenarios, where you have all the Southwest folks running out of water and baking and moving north. That is something that people are looking at. That would have a pretty big impact on the projections of population increases in climates like ours. We also want to look at land price changes and feedbacks from that. So as you start changing the nearshore and landscape environment, you start affecting land prices. That has a huge effect on where people move and how they develop. We're ignoring that right now, and that's something that is very important that we'd like to include. It summarizes a lot of economics that you otherwise, those other things are relevant to those land prices, so it's kind of an aggregate way of thinking about the economy. So improving current EPM models, we'd like to do a lot more model testing through case studies. So for example, in the Beach Erosion Index, you pick several very different environments where you have people that have a lot of local expertise. You can tell them what the model is saying, and they can give you feedback on what they think about what the model is saying. Right now, we don't have a lot of data to do that at the scale of the sound, which is why we want to use case studies. We also want to have expert workshops where we run results by people. We'd like to make better use of some existing data. For example, the Department of Ecology's oblique shoreline photos. We would also like to think about longer-term new data, like LIDAR data, improved bathymetry data, maybe some stakeholder surveys that go into things like why people go to parks, what they value about them, and so on, and what they value about valued ecosystem components, and tie this more directly to human values. There is some survey data, but there's a lot of holes. We'd also like to add additional EPM criterion metrics. So, for example, river delta metrics related to agricultural metrics and salmon restoration metrics, and relating nearshore habitats to intermediate variables as you get closer to what people really care about, and ultimately to metrics that are related directly to human activities that are both drivers and, again, impacted by these changes. So getting further from change to value is another way of saying that. Okay, and then I'll end with a bunch of acknowledgments that I'm not going to read through, but I'll leave this slide up if anybody has any questions. So I know this is complicated stuff, and I did a little bit of a whirlwind tour, but hopefully you at least stayed along the ride well enough. Right.
Can you repeat the question, please?
Could you just... Do you want me to repeat it?
No, I'm sorry. You repeat
it. Are you done or are you still...
Well, I just wanted to know, so the output of your models will be used by a prisoner to decide their sort of restoration priorities or portfolio. Is that right? Or who else would use the model?
That's a very good question. And sorry, I'm trying to go back up to this. Let me repeat the question first. How will this stuff be used by PISNRP within their general investigation, and who else might use it? One thing I would say is that right now, with their deadlines and the way they're working, they can't use it. The idea is in follow-up phases, all they have time for right now is where will sand go? Very physical stuff. Very, very physical endpoints. And I'm not making fun of them. They have a huge task ahead of them. But they want to think about the so what parts of where the sand goes. And so this is something we are working with them. We're meeting with them in January to try to get them to understand better where we're going and so we can react to where... to what they want, so that as they go into their phase two general investigation, they can start getting more into the biophysical side and ultimately start answering so what questions like, why should people care about where the sand goes? And, you know, there's a lot of steps between where the sand goes and a lot of the activities that are of interest. Another direction that I would like to go in is to become more relevant to the Puget Sound Partnership's action plan planning. They're developing their own performance management system. So just think of that as a big systems model of this based on indicators that are, you know, taking the pulse at a bunch of different areas and a bunch of different dimensions. So how Puget Sound improves and changes, what does it mean? I don't think in the current form we can work in that framework. We're probably going to, if we worked with Puget Sound Partnership, we'd have to lose our identity. No longer be the EPM, provide some modeling use for them within their own performance management system framework. So, you know, that's one thing to think about in a project like this, the branding of the project. Sometimes the branding is helpful. It gets your message out. You get some notice. But sometimes it gets in the way when you're trying to do really complicated regional work. You can't have 15 independent branded models that all go into a common purpose. You have to be a little more humble, and your name gets lost, but you provide some use. So, you know, we're trying to have some branding on the PISNRP side and maybe planning ways to lose our identity on the Puget Sound Partnership side. So hopefully that was helpful.
Same question. Is there anybody even thinking about a sort of general management team with all these different models operating somewhere to see if they can't be producing information that makes the overall picture?
Right. So the question is, who's thinking about how to tie together and interpret all the modeling and data collection efforts that are going on? And how to make sense of them. I would say that's one of the things, that's one of the major things that Puget Sound Partnership is trying to do right now. And it's obviously no easy effort. They're trying at the same time to define the problem as they are to collect all these institutions and projects that are going on. It's I would say there's no roadmap for doing that kind of stuff well. It usually comes down to the people involved. You get some real leaders in there. You get some people who know how to make things work, and that's when it succeeds. It's not because you have a formula for doing it. It really comes down to the people involved. Whether or not they're going to accomplish it, I have no idea. But I can say they certainly are talking about how to do it well and thinking about how to do it well. I think that's the most you can say. There are some modeling consortia that are trying to tie together all of the different modeling efforts. There are some, for example, the Stormwater Monitoring Steering Committee, I think that's the right name. They're trying to think about how to work more closely with stormwater quality modelers. So you plan for how to monitor things out in the future. At the same time, you think about how that stuff fits in with modeling. So you not only have the different modeling efforts going on and different data collection efforts, you have the fact that those two worlds don't always talk to one another so well. So I guess the most I can say is they're certainly thinking about that and trying to tackle it. Yes? Our data collection efforts? Well, it depends very much. So what are our data collection efforts? The underlying main data set comes from the geodatabase that was provided to us by PISNRP through their change analysis. That data was collected by different teams of consultants. A lot of it was pre-existing. A lot of it has to do with cleaning up existing data. It was a lot of work, a couple years of work, and a lot of money was spent on that. A lot of the original models, like the park visitation data, is just through making phone calls and finding the right data set. One of the reasons we're doing state parks is because we have data. There are other things we're interested in, like other recreational beach use outside of state parks. Very little data, or the data that's there is very messy. Marina use, for example, but again, we just have not identified a database. Original data collection is hugely expensive. So as a modeler, often what you do is you model what you have data for, and that's just the way it works. But one of the things you can use the model for is to justify new data collections. You can say, gee, if we only had this kind of data, this model would be so much better. You can use that as a justification for encouraging particular kinds of data collection.
As far as timing goes, with the current DNR natural resources discussion at state level, as far as data collection, data management, is there going to be any effort to make any sort of inputs to that discussion?
Yeah. We are, again, depends on which model. So I'll use an example, the eelgrass habitat suitability model. We're working with DNR, meeting with Tom Mumford from DNR tomorrow morning, where we're going to talk about what we can do in the near... This is the way the conversation usually works. What can you do in the near term, and what can you do longer term? I would say the way that the organization works is tackling it issue by issue and effort by effort, and it's just through a network of modelers meeting with other modelers and data collectors and funders. So it's really through networking right now that we're tackling that, nothing more formal.
Let's thank Bill.